Hi there, welcome. This is Dan Denning from Money Week Research in Capital and Conflict. I am joined today on a special broadcast with my friend John Stepik, the editor of Money Week magazine. Hello, John.
Hi, Dan. Morning.
Good morning. John and I have decided to combine forces this morning because we have a guest in the studio who's come all the way from Vienna to visit London. She's got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the European Union. We're going to talk about Volkswagen. We're going to talk about immigration. We're going to talk about Britain's future in Europe. And we might even talk about economics as well. But let me first introduce our guest. I'm pleased to welcome Barbara Colm to the show. Dr. Colm, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, John.
Just a quick background on Barbara. She is the president of the Friedrich Hayek Institute in Vienna, and she is the director of the Austrian Economic Center in Vienna. And we won't get into that straight away, although I'm pleased to have you on the show because I've been studying and talking about Austrian economics for years, since I first read The Road to Serfdom back in, I think it was 1997. Never heard of it. I'd only ever heard of John Maynard Keynes. And so for me to read Hayek and to be introduced to his world of ideas was just, it was a revelation. So personally, I'm happy that you're on the show. We'll get into Austrian economics in a minute, but I watched an interview before you came on the show, and it was an interview you gave several years ago, and you said two things which I wanted to ask you about today and see if your opinion on them has changed. You said the European Union as we know it will not exist in 10 years, and that the EU is a very expensive peace project. What did you mean by that?
Well, as you have seen, we have done a couple of more bailout programs in the past years. Greece is still a mess. There is no light on the horizon. This is one issue. We have wasted years of and months to solve this problem. We have not solved it. And we were, by we, I mean the people in Brussels, were unable to foresee what was going on in the Middle East and in the Far East, and they did not have a solution at hand, because it was obvious that this refugee crisis will pop up sooner or later. It was just a question when, and there was nothing at hand. And so we have broken another set of rules, which is the Schengen Agreement right now. The European Union obviously is unable to solve the problems. And what we have seen, and what I meant back then, the European Union that was originally this great peace project, mm-hmm. does not work. It's a political project that is driven by politicians, but it has lost its context. It's completely detached from the citizen, from the individual. Mm. So it's the politicians on the one hand who live in a, I would say, in a parallel universe. And on the other hand, you have reality, you have the individuals, you have the enterprises, they have to deal with everyday's problems, and there is no solution for that.
Now, when you said it as we know it, it won't exist in 10 years, what do you think it'll look like in 10 years?
Well, I think it will have to become a little bit more flexible.
Yeah.
And this will be, of course, my ideal version. I don't hope, and this would be the bad solution, if we go for more bureaucracy and for more central planning and for more, big government and more coordinated policies out of Brussels, because I think Europe has always been most successful when economic entities were larger than political ones. So having said that, I'm against centralization, and I rather want solutions that are in context with what is happening on the ground.
So let me, before I turn it over to John, obviously I'm not British, I'm an American citizen, I'm a dual citizen actually from Australia as well. So as you know, a referendum in Britain is scheduled for the end of 2017 on whether or not Britain should remain in the European Union. So let's say for a minute you can vote in that referendum. What do you vote and why?
Well, I would definitely not vote for more centralization. I would vote for more independence. But not being a British citizen, it's always easier to give advice from outside. But it's always the pro and cons. What would Britain, from an economic perspective, lose? What would the British businesses lose? However, I don't see much of a problem, because a good economy can adapt itself and can fix its needs on the market. You are not in the euro, luckily, so you don't have to think about that. And I think not having to live with the one size fits all problems that come along with a stronger union is probably an advantage.
So you said you don't think economically Britain loses much by leaving the EU. Is that right?
Yeah.
John, do you agree with that?
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, from an editorial point of view, our view in Moneymaker is broadly that we should leave the EU, mainly because the problem is, it's more, as far as we can see, the European Union is all about a move towards greater centralisation and greater bureaucracy. So in the long run, that's not something that we think Britain should be part of. I mean, obviously, whenever it happens, there might be a certain amount of disruption, but you're probably talking about in the short term, and it will probably be less than people think. I mean, unless Europe itself wants to cut its own nose off to spite its face, then you know, the kind of trade issues that we have shouldn't be huge. My own view is that Britain should take the risk and kind of leave the EU, particularly if we can't get a better deal, which I don't think we will.
I mean, the point is, and therefore I think it's a very important issue to discuss, you as Brits are able to force the EU to reform from inside. And I think we have lost
this. That's not how it feels from here, by the way, just so you know.
No, I mean, you know, we have completely forgotten about the four freedoms, and we have completely forgotten about the big picture.
Now, what are the four freedoms? Like,
well, the four freedoms, the free movement of labor, the free movement of capital, the free movement of people. I mean, all these things have completely, you know, do not exist. I mean, as I told at the beginning, Schengen. What is Schengen? I mean, just to give you one example. So I think we Europe, the idea is great. And I think having borders, you know, just outside borders that are protected, but we don't do that. We have completely forgotten about this topic. And only now that this refugee and migration problem pops up, we start thinking about it again, or after the Ukraine problems have started, we all of a sudden think that there is more than what we have, than central bureaucracy out of Brussels.
Let me ask that immigration question in the context of the Austrians, and I'll try to preface it, because I know she would have loved to have been here, but MoneyWeek's editor-in-chief Maren Somerset-Webb last night went to a book launch for Matt Ridley. And Matt Ridley, great author, great thinker, The Origins of Virtue. I really enjoyed his work. And I haven't read the book, but one of the premises of the book, from what I saw yesterday, was very Austrian, that evolution, which is the subject of his book, isn't necessarily designed. It's that order emerges spontaneously as a design feature of nature, that without people going in and making rules explicitly, evolution produces orderly results. Not all the time, but in terms of culture and the institutions that we have, things like common law and the free market, these are not the products of people sitting in a closed room designing rules that all of us must obey. They emerge, and that we shouldn't tinker with them. Which I think is a very Austrian idea. It's Hayek's idea of spontaneous order.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So in the context of the immigration and what you said about the four freedoms, people are an asset, right? You want minds, you want talent, you want human energy. That's the thing. Human action, as Mises said, is the great wellspring of all of our prosperity. So is there an Austrian view on the immigration crisis that includes, I think, a section on the rule of law?
Well, there is no clear Austrian line. So Mises was of different opinion than, for example, Rothbard, which you would not believe or think of. But in principle, Austrians, libertarians are of the belief that, of course, the borders should be open, that opportunity should be provided to them, and the market solves the problem if you leave the market, if you let the markets work.
Yeah.
What we have seen also in this, and I would call it migration and refugee crisis, because we have to look at the flows of people in a different way, maybe we can come to that later, is that with the bureaucracy that we have forced on not only on our nation states but also on those refugees and on all over Europe, that we will not, that we are unable to solve it. So we actually block the mechanisms of the markets, and so there is no reason why we should not allow the people to come into our countries and to work. And I think this is the biggest problem, that we do not allow them with all this bureaucracy until they get the asylum status, et cetera, et cetera, that they are unable to work. And then they are sitting in camps, and it's a waste of resources on the one hand. And on the other hand, you have people who play with the fears and create this fear mongers, literally, and say, hey, you know, those people take away our jobs. Yeah. I mean, of course, but it's competition, and these people who come in are probably willing to work for less just because they want a job, because they want to improve their lives. And eventually, by creating cheaper labor or by having cheaper labor, we become more productive, which in the end helps other people.
Yeah.
To consume and to buy more. So it's this Austrian business cycle that will help us get out of this mess.
I mean, that's I think that's an interesting point, and I have a lot of sympathy personally with that view. I'm a kind of open borders person. Obviously, the rise of parties like UKIP in the UK, the SNP in Scotland, actually they're explicitly nationalist, although they're often not associated with the immigration debate. And obviously there's various parties in France, like the Front National. I mean, some people would argue that the issue with immigration is a social and cultural thing. You know, like immigrants from the Middle East may have views that the people in the UK are not so keen on, or there might be disruption to kind of settled communities, not enough infrastructure. I mean, what's your response as an Austrian to those sorts of critiques?
I mean, I think this is, you mentioned something which is very important, integration.
Mm.
And we cannot allow people to integrate if they are left in camps and by themselves and living a miserable life. So it's, I think the most important thing is to allow them to get to the job market. And there, I think, if we look at what is happening, especially in continental Europe, if we look at the Balkan route, if we look at Hungary, if we look at Austria, and then those route that goes to Germany, we have to distinguish between three sets of migrants. One of them, and this is the one which can be covered easily, is the group which are not war refugees, which are economic refugees, which are the people who leave Kosovo and the Southern Balkans. Yeah. Those people have been and had been our guest workers 30 and 40 years ago, and they should immediately be given a working permit and the status. I mean, if we had extended the European Union faster, they would be part of the European Union anyhow. So it's actually ridiculous, and there is no reason why we put them into those refugee camps or in this migration camps. And this, so you can eliminate one third of the people immediately, which reduces the crisis. The second part is the war refugees from Syria, from Iraq, from Lebanon. Those people definitely need our help, and we need to open the borders for them. And I think that most of them, after they've gone through the process, will, if their country is hopefully for them in some kind of order again, will return. They most likely will not stay. And the third group, and this is something where we have our biggest problems and where fearmongers play their cards, is probably the group of the young black Muslims coming from African countries who are actually economic or seek economic asylum, if you want to call it like that. I mean, they just want to come to Europe because it's a better and nicer place to live. And they hear that we have a lot of social benefits and redistributional mechanisms. So this is actually our own fault that we opened those gates and let those floods come in. And here I think we definitely need also to say, hey, stop it. I mean, redistribution on the national level is already terrible. We have, with the Greek process, we have started the supranational level, and now we start the transcontinental. I think this is a bit too much for our taxpayers.
I think this is a great chance, though. This is exactly the right time to be having this discussion about what Europe stands for and what Britain stands for, because in the context of what you said, when you talk about I want to bring it back to the United States for a minute, because it's where I'm from. But what's interesting about it is America is a country built on immigrants, right? All of European immigration there, people left their country because they wanted to religious freedom or they wanted more economic opportunity. Precisely the sort of people you want coming to your country, by the way. So there's Italians, Germans, Poles, Brits, Scottish, Irish, Russians. You know, there's all these different subsets. But at least in the first half of the 20th century, and obviously in the late 19th century, those people didn't identify with the old country. They came to America to be Americans. And when they came to America, there was a set of ideas to which they subscribed, which I think are generally pretty Austrian ideas. And a lot of our readers may not be familiar with those, and I'm going to put them out there, see if you agree with them, and see whether these ideas have as much resonance or purchase either in Britain or in Europe as a whole. So the ideas that I would describe that American immigrants embraced wholeheartedly were the idea of individual liberty, small government, low taxes, entrepreneurship, and the rule of law, the secular rule of law. That the law applied to everybody equally, and the authority of the law did not come from God, but it came from a constitution or set of written rules that didn't change, that were easy to understand, and applied to everybody equally. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but that, to me, worries me, because I don't see any consensus on those issues in Europe right now. So now you have a wave of human people coming into a political environment where there's no agreement on these basic values.
I think we in Europe have lost those basic principles. And one of them is, for example, the achievement principle or competition. I mean, to compete for young students is, you know, nice in soccer or car racing or whatever. But if it means, you know, I have to compete with my next door neighbor for a job or for a better education, then no. We leave that to government. They can solve our problems. We don't fix our problems ourselves. So the self-responsibility, the achievement principle, and competitiveness is something that we have completely forgotten in Europe. And one more thing is, I think what is very true for the United States is the pursuit of happiness. But you can do it yourself. You are self-responsible. You have to fix it yourself. You can take your fate into your own hands. And this is what we have delegated to our governments in Europe. And I think we need to put the reset button in people's brains or heads to go back to these basic principles that are so important. And of course, they are part of what the Austrian school has always described.
Right.
That is interesting, because, I mean, do you think that's possible? Certainly within a European context, but part of the big problem in Europe is we have, you know, a massive group of nation states who really don't have that much in common with each other. I mean, Portugal and Germany, you know, they're both nice countries, both nice populations, but they don't see things the same way. And obviously Greece is just a whole other kind of, you know, kettle of fish. How can you get back to the point where, if you want to kind of hit a reset button? I mean, surely the whole thing has to break up back to its constituent parts.
I think we, first of all, need to understand and keep in mind that we are luckily a diverse people in Europe, and are many diverse people. If peoples doesn't exist, so people. This is one thing, and I think this is important, because this one size fits all thing created out of Brussels, centrally organized, will never work for us. And by the way, it doesn't work for the United States as well. I mean, people understand that Texas is different. It's the free state of Texas than, for example, California. These are different things, and luckily they are. And my ideal version for a solution would be to have the Europe of the competing regions and getting rid of this huge national states that are bankrupt and bust anyhow. But allow the smart solutions that evolve on a local and regional level, where the individual, where the citizen can look around and where local governments compete for the optimal size of government, for ideal tax structures, and where the citizen has a say in certain things, like, you know, direct democracy.
That's very revolutionary thought for the 21st century.
Well, we have to get back to this again.
Well, that's what revolution is, isn't it? It's a return to an order.
Evolution. I would say it's an evolution because, I mean, Europe, of course, in a global in global competition is a big player. But within, being a big player within, we have to accept that it is diverse. Yeah. So by competing, Europe competing with, you know, India, China, and Latin and the Americas, we probably have to look at our advantages and cooperate and coordinate, divide labor. But this doesn't mean that by competing with each other on a regional level, we don't get to better results. And this is what the Austrian School is about.
Yeah, well, let me put this in the context of money and interest rates, if it's possible, because, you know, we've got Europe has one currency, and we talk about the differences politically, culturally, socially between European countries. Those differences have been... And economically, we know that different countries probably need different interest rates, but they probably need different monetary policies. Part of trying to keep Greece in the EU is to pretend that the price of money should be the same in Greece as it is in Germany, where they have obviously different social and cultural reactions to money. So I haven't really talked to too many Austrians about the criticism of the low interest rate world, and it can be a technical discussion, but why don't I just start it off that way? Are you concerned right now at this point in the world with global interest rates being synchronized at the zero lower bound and central banks seeming to be both out of ideas and out of what we would call policy flexibility?
Yes, I am concerned, but let me quickly get back to your notion or your point that we have one currency in Europe. Luckily, we don't. We just did our roadshow. We were touring 30 countries, and we had 19 different currencies. And most of the countries, I mean, 28 of them were European or in the larger context of Europe. So luckily, there is competition in currencies. And, you know, the point is that the euro is a currency that can be fixed. It still has its flaws, as Friedman already had pointed out. But with what we do now in Europe on the ECB level, with QE and the low interest rates, that definitely will not help solve the problem. It will kick the can down the road for another while. And I fully understand your concern, and I share your concern with the low interest rates. I mean, what are interest rates? The price for money. If you look at that as simple, so money has no price right now. And then you are surprised why you create bubbles if you artificially boost, and those bubbles will start bursting. I mean, we have seen China already, where the air is getting thinner and thinner. We see the U.S. economy is not as solid as people might think it were. Otherwise, they would have risen the interest rates on the 17th of September, as was indicated originally. But obviously, not those labor market numbers are not, you know, kind of that solid. And there are a couple of problems on U.S. soil. And Europe definitely is not in a good shape either.
I want to ask, at the risk of... this is my pet concerned with interest rates. And I think it gets to what John was going to ask. It may or may not get to what John was going to ask about, about Volkswagen. Because one way to look at what's happened with Volkswagen is it's just a straight-up corporate fraud story, and that it could have happened at any time, anywhere, and it's just human nature. It might be happening in other places, but you can put it in that category, and it's not that unique, really. It's kind of interesting, but it's not that unique. Yeah. I would make the argument that you see these sorts of things happen more often in a low interest rate world than otherwise, because one, there's a financial incentive. When money is cheap and credit is free, you've got to find other ways to make money quickly. So it lowers the threshold for people to make decisions they wouldn't normally make if the price of money were not artificially suppressed. And to me, that's where the theoretical Austrian stuff connects with how people live their lives and what happens on a normal basis, is that when you start tinkering with the value of money, you start tinkering with people's values, and the threshold to fraud is lowered. I mean, would you find that anywhere in the Austrian school, or is this just something I'm bringing as with my puritanical American background?
No. I think this is basic principles of the Austrian school. I mean, this is what they started out and learned during the crisis in the 20s and the 30s, what Mises and what Hayek did, why they started out with their business cycle theory, why they explained how important an underpinning of value money needs, why Hayek later in his late days in his 70s started working on competing currencies. So there are plenty of reasons why we have to be very careful. And there is this great story about Mises saying how he would stop inflation. And it just says, turn off that noise. And he meant actually the printing machines that were printing money back then in the 20s in Austria.
Right. John, was that what you were going to go with?
Well, I think that's true. It's money serves a function as almost kind of a social glue. It's in a way, it's a representation of trust, because effectively it's just a bunch of IOUs being passed around each other. And the other thing that I find interesting at the moment is that, you know, you're talking about the price of money being zero at the moment. I mean, one of our kind of central bankers last week was basically talking about ways to make the price of money even less than zero. You know, so how do we make it negative? And his big idea is to replace paper currency with digital currency, but it's digital currency that's only controlled by the government. So you can impose negative interest rates and essentially force people to spend their money before it gets taken away from them. I'm sure I've got an idea what your reaction to that is, but how do you feel when you hear central bankers bringing these ideas up? They're published in the mainstream press, often favourably. What's the argument against that?
Teach them economics as a basic principle. Sorry, but you cannot spend your way out of bubbles or out of crisis. It has never worked. So you have to do your homework and go back to the principles and do your job. And also as a banker, as a central banker, you have to do your job. And you cannot follow this prospect much longer. Yeah. And I already said it. Politicians who are intervening more and more. We haven't had so many politicians in the last century into this dimension intervening in monetary policy. And now they are all over it again and just use it for their advantages of, you know, just purely to be reelected and playing the best public choice theory as you can get. And as long as we allow these processes to continue, we will not find a way out of this downward spiral. And it's a vision, an illusion that they create, and these illusions will not survive.
Just on that point, because the other thing, just bringing it back to politics for a moment, obviously in Britain, the major opposition party is now being led by someone who's very far left, certainly by recent experience. And obviously in America, we've got Donald Trump, who I see as part of the same phenomenon, making massive running for the Republican candidacy. Do you think that this political reaction is related to the whole low interest rate kind of world that we live in?
Yeah, I mean, look at what has happened in Greece and with Syriza again.
Yeah.
I mean, again, this political elite is detached from reality. And they serve their own interests, and they don't serve their people and their countries and the individuals that vote for them, unfortunately.
I think it's also that they're forgetting what you said, that if they had studied their Austrian economics, or even just gone back to Adam Smith,
yeah,
you know, there's a connection between economic liberty and political liberty. And what people, I think what voters all around the world are reacting to is a sense of unfairness that's been created by bad monetary policy. Mm. It's clearly not worked for people on wages. It's clearly worked very well for people who can borrow money who already own financial assets. And now to perpetuate that system, you have people like Andrew Haldane from the Bank of England, whose step not only is negative interest rates on your savings, but people are understanding there's something not just anti-democratic, but anti-freedom about that. Mm. That if you don't have freedom to make decisions with your money, if it's not your money, if it's not in your pocket, it's not yours. You're not free. And I wanted to ask you about this because you did this huge roadshow earlier this year, the Free Market Roadshow. You're getting ready to do another one. And I want you to tell our listeners about that and how they can hear more from you and from the Free Market Roadshow. But other than economics, when people show up to these roadshows, what are they interested in? Is it the economy? Is it personal freedom? Is it liberty? Or is it some combination of all of those?
It's a combination of all of those, because every year, of course, we cover different topics and what is relevant on the bigger issue and combine it with local needs. But I think what the common denominator is reason. And we have lost reason. Yeah. And we have to speak up and deliver this message again. And, you know, you can live beyond your means for a certain time, but eventually you go bust. And you have to take bear the consequences. I mean, as Lady Thatcher pointed out, eventually people run out of other people's money. And right now with QE, it takes even longer. But the fact is there, and we just cannot be blind to this fact and must open the people's eyes. And this is what the roadshow does on one hand. On the other hand, we of course educate also in Austrian economics. We have great speakers coming in from all parts of the world. Different views, of course, because it doesn't make sense to only preach to the converted already. We want a huge debate. We want people to engage in the debate and learn about how to fix the problems, what homework need to be done. And eventually, in the end, it doesn't matter from which political spectrum you solve the problem, as long as you fix it. And the point is, in next year's topic, one of the topics will be tax competition. And, you know, if we compete for lower taxes, the citizen ends up in a much better and more freer place. And you pointed out before, Dan, our governments and the government sector has grown so big in Europe that there is not much left for the individual citizen from his own money that he earns, that he doesn't have to redistribute. For example, in Austria, we have had the Tax Freedom Day on August 21st this year. I mean, imagine.
So that means you work until August on a calendar year basis. You're working until August just to pay your taxes. Anything after August is yours?
It is mine, finally. I mean, for the average Austrian, the average. I mean, there are people who pay much longer.
How does that compare to the rest of the Europe? Is that about average or is
No. You're still a little bit better off. Germany is end of June. Right. Switzerland, of course, is a leader in April already. The U.S. is also in April. So most of Western Germany is between May, June-ish. But we in Austria have had a couple of bank bailouts, and we've had a couple of more redistributive policies in the past that it's getting worse and worse right now. So we really need to be careful on that. And this is something what citizens, individuals need to reconsider. What is the task of government? And just eliminating all the tasks that are not productive and that we don't need. So it's principle, the rule of law, full stop.
Well, I'd say we've got a big uphill climb, but I think you're right. Like discussing it, I can tell you that when we publish ideas like this in Money Week and in Capital and Conflict, we get a lot of support. And based on the success of the pollsters in both Greece and Britain recently, it may turn out that there's a fair chunk of the European public that is sympathetic with these views without maybe knowing that they're Austrian or knowing their origin. So I would take that as an encouraging sign. If people want to find out more about your work, you're the director of the Austrian Economic Center, president of the Friedrich Hayek Institute in Vienna. How can they hear more from you or find out more from you online?
Well, they can find out about our Austrian Center via www.austriancenter.com. Then, of course, Hayek Institute. AT or com, doesn't matter. And what is most important for the roadshow, we have a website, is freemarket.rs.com. And or just put in free market roadshow and it will pop up immediately. And we have over 90 partners all over Europe and friends who share the same values and want people to engage in these ideas.
And will you be coming to London on the next roadshow?
Of course we will be coming to London.
Okay, well, stop
by as soon as we as soon as we have the official date, I will let you know.
All right, well, thank you. Our guest today has been Dr. Barbara Kolm from the Friedrich Hayek Institute in Vienna and the director of the Austrian Economic Center. Thanks for coming by, John.
Thanks, Pavel. That was great.
Okay, cheers.
Thank you.